Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Peter Singer is often described as the world's most influential living philosopher. His 40 books have appeared in more than 25 languages, the most popular being Animal Liberation, written in 1975. Since 1999, he's been the Ira DeCamp Professor of Bioethics in the University Center for Human Values at Princeton University. His new book is The Most You Can Do, where he explains what effective altruism is, how it is practiced, and how its followers determine which causes to support. And he continues his critique of traditional philanthropy. Again, the name of the book is The Most Good You Can Do, How Effective Altruism is Changing Ideas About Living Ethically. The book is published by Yale University Press, and we welcome Peter Singer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Very nice to have you with us. What got you thinking about altruism and especially effective altruism?
Well, I've been thinking about altruism in particular the context of what we ought to be doing for the global poor for more than 40 years now. I wrote an article back in 1972 called Famine, Affluence, and Morality, in which I raised this issue. But the interesting thing is, although the article was widely reprinted and has been used in a lot of classrooms and discussions, it's only in the last few years that people have really started saying, yeah, we ought to be really actually doing something about this as individuals. We ought to be living in accordance with the idea of being an effective altruist. And we've actually had a social movement forming of effective altruists who talk about how best to do this, how best to be effective in doing it, and what kind of causes they want to work for. So, you know, it's a long-term interest of mine that I think is now in a whole new phase.
So looking at the baseline here, how do you define effective altruism? What makes altruism effective in your mind?
Well, the effective altruist will want to get evidence about the impact of his or her work, whether that's a monetary donation or volunteering or something else. It's not enough to just do that on an impulse. It's not enough to just say, well, this organization sent me a brochure with nice pictures of smiling kids and I want to help. You have to really ask the tough questions, such as, what is my donation going to do? What difference will it make? Will it make a bigger difference if I give, let's say, whatever I can afford? Let's say I'm going to give $1,000. Will it make a bigger difference if I give it to this organization or that organization? And how do I know? So effective altruists are interested in asking those questions and then looking at the evidence and making sure their donations, their altruistic work, is actually going to the most effective of these organizations.
You open the book by telling us a story about a young man by the name of Matt Wage, who was one of your students. Why begin there? Tell us about his story.
Well, I begin there because Matt's story, I think, is not necessarily typical, but it does illustrate a way of thinking about your whole life that some effective altruists find interesting. And that is, so Matt was a very bright student, very good at philosophy, and seemed to be headed for an academic career. He had an offer of going to graduate school at the University of Oxford, one of the best graduate schools in the world, and, you know, no doubt could have, perhaps still could if he wanted to, end up as a professor. But after thinking about what impact he would have on making the world a better place as a professor, and asking himself whether there was some other way in which he could have a bigger impact, he made the decision, which will be surprising to some of your listeners, to instead accept a job on Wall Street. Now, you might say, well, why would he do that? Why would he think that's a good thing to do? It's not because of the work that he's doing on Wall Street specifically. It's rather because he can earn a lot more money that way. And because he can earn a lot more money, he can donate a lot more money to the most effective charities. So within a year of graduating and getting a job, Matt was able to donate a six-figure sum to the charities that he found most effective. He basically, you know, unlike most people who get that kind of income, didn't really change his lifestyle, just kept the same lifestyle as he had as a student, but used that money to help those organizations that he'd researched and decided would do the most good with his money.
You have written a lot on this subject, but I'm interested in hearing you briefly describe some of your concerns when it comes to traditional philanthropy, what we think of as traditional philanthropy.
Yeah, so my concerns are really that most people don't really think too much about where they're giving their money, and a lot of it is not doing as much good as it could. Now, that's not because the organizations they're giving to are frauds or all the money is going to administrative expenses or fundraising or anything like that. It's because I think some areas of giving are just not as beneficial as others. And I single out in particular in the book giving, for example, to a museum or an art gallery, or just very recently we've had the example of David Geffen's gift of $100 million to the Lincoln Center in New York City for the renovation of what used to be called Avery Fisher Hall, the concert hall there, and which is now going to be called David Geffen Hall. Now, you know, I don't think that if you've got $100 million that you're willing to spare, I don't think that renovating a concert hall for wealthy Manhattanites is anywhere near the best thing to do with it. I mean, if you compare that with what you could do in developing countries, for example, it costs about $50 to restore sight in somebody who has a cataract. And in America, of course, people who have cataracts would all get them removed because it's cheap and your health insurance will pay for it. If it won't, Medicare will pay for it if you're over 65, as most such people are. But in developing countries, there are millions of people who are blind and who could easily have their sight restored. And $100 million could perhaps restore sight for 2 million people, or even if you think $50 is not the right figure, it might be just 1 million, even if it was 500,000. That would just seem to me a far better thing to do than to renovate a concert hall. So that's just one example of many about how I think philanthropy is often misdirected.
And obviously it is up to the giver, right? I mean, it's up to them to decide where the money that they have earned, that the money that they have, that they want to give. And is it hard for us, or should it be hard for us, to judge what goes through a person's mind of where that money ends up?
Well, you're right that it is up to them. And of course, you know, I'm not suggesting that we change that in any legal or coercive sense. I just think that I'm trying to offer advice to people who are making that decision. And yes, I do think we can offer useful advice there, basically in saying, if you really are intending to do the most good, then some causes, and within those particular causes, some organizations are more effective than others. So please think about this. Please don't just give impulsively, or don't just say, you know, because I have a passion for classical music, I'm going to give to renovate a concert hall. Think about the impact that you could have on other people. Put yourself in the position of those other people. Think about the difference of being blind or being able to see, and especially if you're a poor person in a developing country where you don't get the kind of support and services that you might get over here. So that's really what we're asking people to do, to reflect before they make those decisions, to gather together some evidence about the impacts of their decisions, and then what I hope is that they will make different decisions.
It would seem, using that rubric, if you will, that probably, or at least usually, that social and humanitarian causes would always trump arts and cultural causes.
I think that in the present world situation, where we have about 1 billion people in extreme poverty, and as a result of that, we have, you know, well, the problem of blindness I've mentioned. We have 6.3 million children dying each year before their fifth birthday because of preventable poverty-related causes. I think the answer is yes. I think they do trump cultural causes, especially cultural causes here in affluent countries. You know, to say that is not to say that the arts are not a good thing. I think they are, but the arts have flourished in many circumstances without getting substantial funding, philanthropically or otherwise. You know, people with a creative urge are going to keep creating. So I just don't think it's the top priority in the situation we're in. You know, if we could deal with these other problems, then sure, let's focus on the arts then. But not in the present situation, is my view.
How much work is on us, is on the giver, to determine where their money best goes? And I guess I'm interested in where personal choice does come in here, of where you look at and say, okay, this is the money I have, and where I give the money, is that guided by the need, or is there some preference and concern on my part that is a part of that equation?
It's, you know, it's completely the donor's choice, but I'm simply providing some things for donors to consider when making that choice. And I hope they will, just as, you know, if you like it, people can make all sorts of choices about their lifestyles and their habits, but we think some choices are better than others. I mean, in this society, you're perfectly legally free to get yourself blind drunk every evening. But probably most people, if you had a friend who was doing that, would say, this is not the best way to live. But it's still that person's choice in the end. So in a similar way, it's people's choices. If they want to give their money to causes that are less effective than others, I neither have the power to stop them, nor you know, would I really try to stop them. But I would try to say to them, look, if you're a thoughtful person, think about these options that you have. And if you say, well, this is my passion, this is my preference, in the end, you do get to make the choice. But should you really be following that preference rather than perhaps developing a different preference? We can encourage people to change their preferences, to reconsider their preferences, and maybe they'll find it more satisfying and more fulfilling to know that they're helping a large number of people in great need rather than that they're helping a number of people who are already very comfortable and whom they're not making such a big difference to the quality of their lives.
So let me tweak the question and ask it this way. Is there an effective system to help in someone's philanthropy to make sure that they are doing the most effective thing with their money?
Well, there are certainly some things that they can look at. For example, there are websites. I've got one called The Life You Can Save, thelifeyoucansave.org, and people can go to that website and they can get information and suggestions about where to give. There's also givewell.org, which does a lot of research on that topic and has much more detailed information if people want to go into it more fully. So you don't have to actually go and do all the research yourself. It's out there online. You just have to find the places where it is. And then when you're well informed, and there's also websites, by the way, like effectivealtruism.org that people get together to discuss questions about the broader idea of living altruistically in a way that is also effective. So I really want people to know that there's all this information out there and to make use of it, because at the moment, most people, there's lots of people who give to charity, but most of them, I think, aren't even aware of that information and haven't really reflected on a variety of different possibilities.
And I assume that information changes. I mean, what may be the most effective thing today may not be the most effective thing a year from now.
Absolutely, yes, and those lists do change. Most of the organizations revise their lists in time for the giving season, which begins just after Thanksgiving. So, yeah, you will find in sometime in November, organizations will be looking at their lists. GiveWell or The Life You Can Save will be looking at their lists and thinking about what has changed and what might need to be updated.
Peter Singer is the author of the new book, The Most Good You Can Do. He is the Ira DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and Laureate Professor at the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. Again, the name of the book is The Most Good You Can Do. Peter Singer, a great pleasure to have you share with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe. It was good talking to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Most Good You Can Do. Peter Singer is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.